Good afternoon. So, last time we finished up covering double and triple indirect blocks, this inode-based scheme of having a list of block pointers, and for the latter parts of the list we use more and more indirection as we got to later and later parts of the file, meaning that for small files we just stored the block numbers in one place, and for large files we spread it out more and more. Talked about trying to keep the data for a file and its directory, and its metadata all in one area of the disk to take advantage of how hard disks work and that they really want to have you write to things which are at similar locations on the disk and read from similar locations in order to be fast and avoid seek times. The mechanism we had for that was block groups, where basically we divided our file system in sort of these mini file systems, and we tried to keep the data for each directory in one of these groups, assuming it fit. And then we talked about the distribution of file sizes people typically see, and we saw that there were, two issues we wanted to solve. I guess I forgot to write down here. So we talked about two solutions for problems that arise from file sizes. So one was that, lots of files are small and we don't want to use a whole block for them. We want to keep our blocks reasonably big, so we could divide the blocks into fragments, only to deal with those small files, but usually we'd allocate the whole blocks for bigger files. And I said for big files, we really want to allocate like this giant run of blocks, and we don't want to actually store that it's 1,000, 1,001, all the way up to like 2,000. So instead we store these extents where we say, the file has data from block 1,000 to block 2,000 rather than storing all those block numbers. But that had the challenge that we need to now find these contiguous sets of blocks. My mic isn't on. Okay, now it's hopefully on. And extents, made it worth doing that, at least. We also talked about efficiently storing sort of key value data on disks. So one, frequent example is directories. If we have a directory with 10,000 files in it, we don't want to scan that list of 10,000 files to find it. But in FAT and the X36 file system and extended to, that's what we were doing. We were just looking through all the files. So we have this alternative idea of storing a balanced tree on disk, like a search tree, but rather than having it be a binary tree like you're used to from 2150, we made it a non-binary tree, so each node of the tree could be a whole either sector or block that we would read all at once, and so we'd have less layers in the tree, which would just mean less reading from the disk to get to a particular place, but we still have the advantages of the hierarchical structure. So, any questions on what we covered last time? Okay, so our last topic last time was looking at keeping multiple copies of data on disk. We said one strategy was we could mirror it, we could keep, just put it on two disks. Then we talked about, we don't want to have twice as much storage compared to what we're storing. So we can use this scheme where we use what's known as parity and store the XOR of two things as a way of having redundancy. So with this scheme, I can get rid of any one of the disks and I still can recover all the data. So I can survive any one disk failing. But the cost is that now reading and writing might be more complicated. In particular, writing is more complicated because every time we write something, we learn we need to write two things. And to write one of those things, the parity disk, we need to compute the XOR, which means we might need to read something. So mentioned that we had this scheme for dealing with, three disks storing two disks worth of data. And we can extend this to have four disks storing three disks worth of data. So here we're saying, I can still lose one disk, but that's now a quarter of my disk, so I'm less tolerant to failures. Like, I can handle less hard drives just breaking, but I'm spending less extra money, per gigabyte of storage for that redundancy, for the ability to handle something's failing. So after I've done this, let's say I want to replace sector 3 here with a new value. How many reads and writes do I need now? So you're saying 2 writes and 2 reads. So what are the, so you have, say, 2 writes. What are the 2 writes you're thinking of?
They were replacing, or B1 mod to write there, and mod to change.
Yeah, so because B1 changed, this one definitely needs to change. And because B1 changed, the parity, which is a function of that, also changed. And you said 2 reads. What are the reads? Yeah, so you're saying we read 2 and 3, and that's what we need to compute the new parity value. Yeah, so that would be the most simple solution. We have an alternative, which is the same number of reads, which is we could read B1 and BP to compute the new parity value, because we could say BP XOR the original BP and the original B1. BP, the original BP XOR B1 is going to be B2 XOR E3 because of how XOR cancels out. If you XOR something with itself, it cancels out. But either way, it's still 2 reads. Okay. So this is a scheme which works, but you see that writes now require more effort. Notably, at least if we're writing like contiguous sectors, like we don't have to do as many like reading data. So it's not, maybe not actually that bad in practice, assuming our file system's good at not writing one sector at a time, but writing a whole bunch together. But a complaint people often have about this is that we're actually doing a lot more work on this parity disk here. You notice that we always write to it. That if I wrote to B2, I'd also be updating the parity disk. If I wrote to B3, I'd be updating the parity disk. So a complaint people have about this scheme is that it means that disk 4 is getting a lot more work to do. So it's going to determine how our performance, as far as like how fast we can write. Well, we're going to have to wait for disk 4 all the time, even if we're writing to different places on different disks. And it means that in terms of failure, well, disk 4 is probably going to fail first because we're using it more. So a solution to this is to divide the parity across disks in this sort of fashion, where we say for the first set of sectors, we put it on disk 4, then disk 3, then disk 2, just to spread out that load. And this is known as RAID 5. So, questions? Yeah?
So, I'm guessing that big data centers use some sort of RAID for that data.
So, the question is, do big data centers use this? And so, the answer is, they use schemes like this. But specifically, RAID is not actually that common at really large scale. But schemes that use the same ideas, especially this idea of like you can keep something like a parity data to not keep 2 copies of data but have like 1.5, that is definitely used in big data centers. But often they do it at some level which is not quite a full disk. Yeah?
Is there a reason it's RAID 5 or did it just
have 4? The question is there a reason it's RAID 5? It's basically that it came after 4. So there's more general schemes. So there's something called RAID 6, which came after 5, probably, maybe, which uses something a little more sophisticated than just XOR. And this is what like data centers that want to save space use, which can tolerate 2 disks being lost. So you can extend this sort of scheme to like handle more complicated sets of failures, generally. So this is how we deal with data being lost, yeah.
If I'm just like, say, a home user with like 5 to 10 hard drives, which is like the most popular rate?
So the question is, if you're a home user with 5 to 10 hard drives, what should you do? Like, I mean, it depends on your, I mean, what's the most popular? It varies what people do. I mean, probably, like, if I were recommending things, that if you can afford the storage, this is the simplest thing to do. Like, it's not error prone. Like, it's easy to implementations of this are usually right. I have some bad news about implementations of RAID. They're a little less reliable than this. And if you have the storage, well, it's also better performance. But the advantage of these RAID schemes is that, you know, you don't need twice as much storage, or if you wanted to do that, handle two disks being lost, three times as much storage. Okay. So RAID-like redundancy, so the way this is usually used with a file system is that we'll have something which does this RAID scheme that will appear to the file system basically like a normal disk, but it's just a more reliable normal disk. And we'll either have some hardware or some software that will implement this parity writing and reading. Now, some file systems, and this gets to like the sort of things that data centers do, so data centers will do this usually on top of the file system, but some file systems even do this RAID thing themselves. They don't have the disk do it, but they apply the same concepts for the file system data. And one example is ZFS has the option of doing this type of thing. I know, so I talked about how RAID like keeps extra copies of data. So there's an important missing piece I'm not talking about, which just turns out to be rather complicated to deal with. And this is what happens when I'm writing data, and I've written the parity block but not the other one. How do I make sure that I don't like have my disk be corrupted? Real RAID systems have ways of dealing with this. It's not trivial. And it usually involves a bit of extra storage to figure out what happened in the case where you were in the middle of writing something. And also, this is the part of RAID implementations I've heard the most interesting failure stories for. My favorite one is at Berkeley way back, before my time when I was a grad student there, they apparently had a RAID file system which used non-volatile memory to do this. And by non-volatile memory, what they meant is memory with a battery attached to it. And apparently, a sequence of failures happens where first the alarm for that battery failed, then the battery failed, and then they had the RAID disk fail, and it was bad. So that's like where you hear bad stories. Anyways, so we talked about this scheme, but when implemented correctly, assuming we handle this detail of what happens while the data is being updated, which we can do, basically we just need some extra storage to track what's being updated so we can recover from that. Then we've dealt with not losing data if like disks fail or parts of disk fail. But this doesn't deal with a consistency issue. And let's think about consistency with respect to one operation, which is file creation. We'll do this on FAT. So on FAT, to create a file, I'm going to allocate some place for the file's data. And I'm going to write a directory entry for the file. And maybe my original directory doesn't have enough space yet, so I need to allocate more space for the directory and write the directory entry. So in this case, I'm actually writing to 6 places on the disk for this 3 cluster file. I'm writing FAT entries for the directory in the file, FAT entry for the directory to extend it to add an extra cluster, FAT entries for the file to link those 3 new clusters I'm writing together, and I'm actually writing the file's data, and also the directory entry for the file. So there are 6 things I need to write, and we learn that the way disk writes work is that each of these is going to be like one, like assuming these are one sector, which isn't actually true, each of these like would either be written or not. And the question we might have is, well, what happens if I'm doing this and I have a crash or I lose power? or my battery runs out, or I lose power at home on my desktop. So only some of these are going to be completed. We assume that the disk is not going to put us in a halfway state, which maybe isn't true. But you know, assume these are one sector, so we can know they're completed or not. So there's a question of like what happens, and it depends on what order we do these in. So, example, let's say I do 1 and 2 only. What's the state of my disk going to be? So what's going to happen? Let's say I write only 1 and 2, and then my system loses power, and it comes back up. What's going to happen to my file system? How's it going to look?
According to your FAT entries, it's going to say that like certain clusters are part of your file, but the data there is not what you expected to be.
Okay, so we have FAT entries which are part of a file. So in particular, we have our directory. Might now have some extra directory entries that we weren't expecting. And we have this file which is allocated, but the data isn't there. Also, we haven't written the directory entry. So the file isn't there, but space is allocated. The file is there in the FAT, but it's not there in the directory, so we can't actually get to it. And how about if we write everything but 3? Anything about the new directory cluster? No one else?
Wouldn't it be like the same scenario, or not the same, but like similar in that everything would be set up except you can't access a new file cluster?
Yeah, so the file's there. We can even read the data if we knew where it was on the disk, but we don't have a pointer, we don't have a name for it. So that's some examples. So one thing we file systems often have done to manage this issue of what if I lose power is that they're very careful about the order in which they do these updates. So here we have these 4 updates. Spend a few minutes, check with the neighbor. What do you think is the best ordering to do these updates in? Which do you think leaves the file system in the best state? And all of them are going to have problems. Like, you aren't going to say it's perfect for any order. So who wants to volunteer to propose something they think is good? One of these orders they think is good. I said, you can justify a lot of them. We're going to have a choice that most file systems have agreed on, but it makes a particular compromise. Okay, there. Okay. Okay, so your idea is that we're going to write data. If it's not pointed to yet, that's okay, because at least we aren't showing the user the wrong data. Like, that's your priority. Okay. And that seems reasonable. Any other opinions? Yeah. So you said D? Okay, so we're gonna write the fat entries last. So the idea is that we'll have the pointers, maybe we could figure that out. Okay, but we're also, okay. So we have B and D. So, okay. So the philosophy that most file systems go for is that they're typically going to do, in fact, B, or something like B, something like D. So where the idea is that at every step, we don't want to point to data which isn't there. And the observation here is writing this new FAT entry makes the directory entry we just wrote valid. Or wait, not D. Fat entry, sorry. Writing this new fat, writing the fat entry for the file makes the file clusters we wrote valid. And writing the fat entry for the directory makes the directory entry we wrote valid. And we don't want to make that directory entry there until the file is in place. And if you try to read it, you'll definitely get the right data. So that's usually the big constraint we have, is that we don't write a pointer to data until we've actually have the data it's pointing to. So that's usually what real file systems do. This has some disadvantages in that, you know, the data might be there and you boot up the machine and you don't get it. Like, so there's a longer period where you can have a crash and your data's missing. And that's a choice they have made. Yes?
Is there, an equivalent to, memory leak for, hardware?
This is an equivalent to memory leak. So something notable about, is there an equivalent to memory leak? So yes. So for example, something you'll note here is if we have a crash here, a reason you might not have liked this scheme is now we have a file which has no pointer to it. And if we look at the disk, maybe we could figure out, you know, that, oh, there's this sector that's not used and not marked in the FAT, but it has a directory entry in it. We should link that up. But probably, you're just not going to know about the file from reading the disk. And it has some FAT entries which are used, and that's going to just be wasted space. So that's a disadvantage of this scheme. So this choice here is write pointers after pointed to data, but space for file allocated before file accessible, file pointed to. So we're allocating space for the file by writing its FAT entries. So we're marking those FAT entries as not free. So we won't ever use them again. But that means that even if we don't have the directory entry for the file available to us, we're still going to waste that space. And if we boot the machine back up, we're never going to actually use that space. And you have this space on your disk which is used that you can't reuse for anything else until the file system figures out something's wrong. Okay? And that's a choice that file systems have made, is that even though we're wasting space, they say, that's okay, at least I'm not showing you data that's not real. That's typically the choice they've made. So questions about that? Okay. So let's consider the same problem for the XV6 file system. And here we've split up our data in a different way. So what ordering do we want here? In this case, following the convention I told you. Someone have a proposal, an answer they'd like to defend or exclude? Okay.
You're saying D.
Okay. And what's the reasoning here?
Well, so, in general, we want to do the file stuff before the directory stuff.
Okay.
So 2.6.4 relate to files.
Mm-hmm. So you're doing the free first. So the advantage of doing the free map first is that this way we're not going to accidentally reuse space where we've put data. And that's going to mean we're going to lose less data. Whereas a risk of doing it afterwards is that we might lose that, we might overwrite that data after a crash. That's a reason to do the free first, and then we write the data based on that. Then we update the inode, which we don't do until after we've written the data, because the inode contains pointers to that data. And we want those pointers to be synced. And we have the same procedure for our new directory entry. Okay. And that's the general idea that inode-based file systems have traditionally used when they try to be careful about the order they put things in to keep things consistent. They said, we're going to mark things as allocated before we refer to them, because we'd rather waste space than overwrite data that's actually in use. We're going to write data blocks before pointers to them, because we don't want to point to things which don't have data. We're going to write the inodes before we point to them from directory entries, and we're going to, you know, remove inodes from pointers to sending things before we remove the thing itself, like marking the inode as free. And doing this careful ordering here lets us actually recover from crashes, albeit via a rather expensive procedure. So with this, let's say we have a crash at some point. Let's say, you know, we've written the, you know, we've updated the, you know, we've gotten to the point where we've updated the file inode, but we haven't written the directory entry. Well, we can just scan all the directory entries, all the inodes, and we can find that, oh, we have this inode that wasn't written to a directory, and we can recover that data. We can tell the user, here's a file, I don't know where it goes, but here's some data you might have cared about. And we can either get rid of it or, you know, and recover the space that it was taking up, or at least let the user see its data. And if we have other points in here, we can do the same thing. We can just scan to fix up the things which were wrong. So one thing we can fix up is we can, you know, find all the inodes which are actually not referred to, and we can get rid of them, or let the user say, here's some data, do you care? And we can find data blocks which we've allocated. So let's say we crash here. We can scan all the files to figure out what data blocks actually are free that we can access. And we can say, okay, these ones must have been marked as free, as allocated before we crashed, but we didn't write the data. I'm just going to recover them, get that space back to you, and I'm not going to waste that space forever. So this is a real recovery procedure we can do. It's just very expensive, but hopefully crashes don't happen very often, so maybe that's okay. Let's talk about this for some other cases where we might care about ordering. So let's say I want to do unlink. So I want to remove a directory entry for the file that's not the last one. What do I do? I have two updates to do. I need to overwrite the directory entry to replace it with doesn't point to anything, and then to decorate the file to say this was linked to, this had two directory entries, now it has one. What order should I do those in? Yeah.
Probably you want to decrement last. Okay. If you decrement first and then crash, then you just end up deallocating the file.
Okay, yeah. So you're saying we'll do this last in order to make sure that if we don't do that full recovery operation and figure out that link count isn't right, we don't delete the thing by accident. Yeah, that seems reasonable. So how about when we actually deleted file? What order should we do that in? So we have to change the directory entry, we have to mark the inode as free, and we have to mark the data blocks as free again. What order should that happen in? What principles do we want to, you know, preserve when we are doing this operation? It's something we were trying to do previously with our ordering, and we want to have the same thing happen here. Yeah.
Well, we don't want to point to wrong data.
Okay.
Overwrite first.
Mm-hmm. or we don't want to overwrite first, or? So overwriting is just replacing with nothing. So doing this first is okay. But the principle is do not point to wrong data. Yeah. So if we mark the inode as free first, that's bad. Because now we have a directory entry which points to wrong data, namely a file, an inode, which isn't a file. Yeah. So we don't want to do that first. So probably we first want to overwrite the directory entries. And also, we don't want to mark the data blocks as free before we actually mark the inode as free, because we still have pointers to those data blocks as long as the inode is listed as this is a file. So you want to mark the data blocks as free last. You don't want to actually say they're free until we aren't pointing to them, until we're not going to get confused and say, oh, that's a file. Here's the data for it. And use that space. So yeah, the general principle is that we're going to prefer to waste space rather than ever point to bad data. So we'll have some extra stuff allocated that might not actually be used. And that's OK, because we're at least not pointing to bad data. And we'll use this slow operation of figuring out, is it actually pointed to from somewhere, later on to do the recovery. And that slow operation is done typically by a utility. So on Unix, there's a utility called FSCK, File System Check. On Windows, there's something called CheckDisk. And what this does is it scans through for these sorts of inconsistencies which are left after we do this special ordering. So is there a data block that's still marked as used, but there's actually no inode that refers to it? Is there a data block that two different inodes are using that shouldn't happen with the scheme we talked about? But it can still check for it. Is there an inode that no directory references? You know, so we started writing a file, but we crashed before we could add the directory entry. It can find that. And it just does this by scanning through the entire disk. And if we assume careful ordering works, it can fix errors after a crash. If it doesn't, some of those errors it might also be able to fix. Maybe. So, This was the dominant way that file systems tried to keep consistent, is by, you know, on a crash, you try to automatically run this. One way you could do that is by you just have a write to the file system, maybe in the header, hey, this is currently being changed, and hey, it's not. You set write the hey, it's not being changed on shutdown, so you can detect on boot, oh, I didn't shut down normally, I'm going to do this long file system check thing. Now, there's a big disadvantage of this, and that's that it's pretty slow. So for example, my desktop has a file system with 2.4 million inodes and 379 million data blocks in use. And this utility needs to read all of those inodes and reproduce, figuring out, you know, counting all 379 million data blocks to verify that they're all the data blocks marked as used are actually used. And it also needs to scan through all the directories in there. That takes a while. So it's not something we really want to be doing. So we're going to talk about better alternatives for this, partly to avoid this cost. This is really annoying, even if crashes are relatively infrequent, because with our larger and larger disk, this keeps taking longer and longer to do. Another issue, though, is that the scheme we've used to let us do this recovery, that careful ordering, while it's nice and intuitive and works, it's not very good for disk performance. And if you remember when we talked about disk scheduling, we went through this scan thing where we like wrote to one part of the disk and the other. And this ordering says, well, don't do that. You have to write this, then this, then this. Doesn't matter where they are on the disk. You're doing it in that order, or else we're going to have our data be inconsistent. We're going to have a directory entry pointing to data which isn't valid. And all these things we don't want. And we're going to end up writing to different parts. So we'd like to get back to like taking advantage of how disks want to work, in that we're going to write things in order. We're not going to seek all over the disk, which we've gotten rid of by saying we have to write in exact order, even if it's not how things are laid out physically on the disk. And what we want to get, really, is we want the file system update to be like updating a single sector. Updating a sector either happens or it doesn't, because that's how the disk works physically with its erasure codes. It knows the sector has a value, it checks that the value is consistent, and we want our file system updates to work the same way. And the basic mechanism we'll do is we'll construct our file system in such a way where there's going to be exactly one sector which changes to do some entire operation, like creating a file in a directory. But a problem, of course, is that we don't store all the data for that operation in one sector on the disk. So our trick is that we're going to collect a bunch of updates to various parts of the disk, and we're going to put them in a bucket we're going to call a transaction. And to make this atomic property work, there's going to be one update which tells us, when we're reading the disk, that this whole transaction happened. This whole bunch of updates happened. And one update, if it isn't there, it's going to tell us none of these operations happened. And we're going to store the transaction that we're doing before we actually do the operation. And for reasons that will be clear when we talk about how we deal with what happens if we get interrupted in the middle of a transaction, this is going to be called redo logging. So redo logging, I'm going to show you the sort of thing that the XV6 file system does. So we're going to have, our file system header, and we're going to have a part of our disk we're going to call the log. And rather than actually doing operations first in the normal part of the disk, we're going to do most of our operations in the log. So when we want to create a file, we're going to write a transaction that's a set of updates to the log. So I'm going to write a marker saying, here's the start of a transaction. And the first update is that I need to write the directory entry for this file. I need to write the data block for this file. I need to write the inode for this file. I need to write this part of the free map. We're just going to write all the things that we're planning on update, these intended operations that we need to do for this file update. But we're not going to write them to the real parts of the disk. We're just going to write pointers to saying, I'm going to update this part of the inode array. I'm going to update these data blocks over here. I'm just going to put that in my log before I do it. Then, without updating the rest of the disk, I'm going to write a commit message to the log. And that's the entire directory creation. Now the file is created in the directory. But you're saying, of course, I didn't actually update the real place I store the file. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to, apply the results that are in my log to the disk later on, sometime after I've written that commit record. And eventually, I'm going to have applied those. I'm going to get rid of the log entries once they're applied. So the reason that this is helpful and that this works is that when we write these intended operations, here we're just saying, these are things I'd like to do. And when I write this commit message, I'm saying, these are things I'm promising to do. That the file system's going to have this contract that if I ever write a commit message, I'm going to do the work, no matter what, to make sure that these updates happen. They haven't happened yet, but I'm promising I'm going to do them. And that means that if we have a crash after I write this commit message, I'm going to check the log, and I'm going to do these updates again, hence the name redo logging. And this is going to be in my log even after I've partially done these updates. So I can do some of these updates, like whatever is convenient to write to the disk. But because I have this commit message in my log, I'm saying, okay, the things I haven't done, I'm still promising that they're going to get done. And I'm going to do them again if I need to. So the idea for doing this scheme for our consistency is that we're going to write to the log, to one place on the disk, all the things we're planning on doing. Then we're going to write, I'm committing to do this. Then we're going to do all the updates later. If we crash before we finish writing all the things we plan on doing, we just discard that part of the log. It's okay. We don't create the file at all. We don't have some partial data. We don't have a directory entry that points to nothing. We don't have allocated space that isn't used. We just discard the log, and that's what we're going to do on reboot after a crash there. If we have a crash after we've written that commit message, we're going to, after reboot, we're going to look at the log and we're going to say, well, better do all of that again, just in case it wasn't done. So if not all the actual updates are done to the normal part of the disk, we're going to redo them after crash. So our recovery operation is that on boot, rather than like scanning the whole disk, we're just going to read the log, and any operation with no commit, we're just going to ignore. We're going to say, yeah, we were planning on doing that, but it's not all there, not going to do it. Any operation with commit, we're going to do again. And you might say, well, maybe we already did it. Well, that's going to be okay, because we're going to just do it again, and we're going to just be overwriting data with the same data. It's not going to be a problem. Yeah?
Does that mean writing to a log would take as much work as writing to a real, data?
So the question is, does writing to the log take as much work as writing the real data? We'll get to that later, and that is a good concern with this scheme. The question, what parts of how it solves writing a whole sector at once? So the idea is that because this commit message here is part of a sector, either we have a sector with a commit or we don't. And that's what determines whether anything happens. So there's that one sector, which is the key about whether or not this file was created, including all the operations involved in creating it. Yeah.
I have a question. Okay, so if you create a new file and you have a commit, but you haven't actually created it yet, you're trying to access that file.
So the question is, how does this interact with what if, instead of having a crash, what if, you know, this happens and I'm trying to read from the file? So something the operating system implementing this has to do is it has to make sure that it has cached versions in memory of anything where it hasn't actually done these updates. So part of this scheme is that we're going to basically lock everything that's in the log but not actually written to the real part of the disk in cache, typically. Or we're going to read the log to scan for it. That would be another option, is we could like scan the log for everything, but probably we just lock it in cache. Well, yeah, you could do that, but most operating systems which implement this just say anything that's in the log remains cached until it's out of the log. Or at least written to disk completely. So other questions? But that's a good concern, yeah. I kind of glossed over the runtime management part of this, which is not a trivial part of implementing this scheme in practice. So something I note here is that we say you redo any operation, and we don't actually know when we reboot that when I see something that's committed, that not all these things weren't done. And that means we need to be careful about the things that I write to the log. The operations I write need to be things which are idempotent. So for example, I could say set the link count on the inode to 4. That's idempotent. If I keep doing that, the inode has a link count of 4, no matter how many times I do that. I can't say increment the link count because I'm creating a new directory entry. If I keep doing that, the inode's link count keeps going higher and higher. So I need to choose the first format for my log entries, not the second. Another example would be, I'm going to probably write log entries to say, I'll write this inode number, this data, not allocate a new inode with this data. So if I do it twice, I'm just overwriting an inode. I'm not allocating two inodes with two copies of two pointers to things. And so on. If I'm going to write a data block, I'm probably going to say write data block X. I'm not going to say write a new data block. I'm going to say write freemap entry as allocated, write data block X. I'm not going to say try to allocate a new one each time I redo the log. Because I know that part of the way this works is that it's going to be normal on reboot for me to do something that was already done again. And if we keep rebooting potentially many, many times, so like we have a crash and then another crash and another crash. Okay, so questions about this item potency idea? So that's redo logging. So we write an intended operation to the log, and this is before we touch the real data that's being changed. It's not the primary copy. And we write this in a way that's safe to do twice. So usually by saying set to X, not append to at create new. Then we write a marker saying we're committing to the log, and this is our promise that it's going to be done eventually because we are going to do it. Even if we have a crash, we're going to read the log and do it. And then we actually update the data sometime after that. So this is a very popular technique among file systems, and in this century is what most file systems you're used to do. And they're often called journaling file systems, and that means the log would be called a journal. And in fact, the XV6 file system is one of these file systems. So I'm going to talk to be concrete to give an example of a very simple way of doing this, how the XV6 file system works. So the XV6 log, to keep things simple, they only store one transaction at a time. Real file systems do more because they want to have more things going on at once to like be faster, not have to wait for the previous transaction to finish. XV6, just one. And they have a one sector, which stores what they call the log header. And this is where we write the commit information. And it has a number of blocks in the transaction and the locations in the real data where each of those blocks go. And the rest of the log is just copies of those blocks. So all the operations in XV6's logs aren't things like set the link count to one. They're just change this block of the disk to this. That's the only format they write to keep things simple. That means they're writing maybe more data than they need to the log, but it makes things very consistent. So the way XV6 tracks whether things are committed is they don't actually write the word commit or anything. They just change this number of blocks to a non-zero value when they're committing. So the way a transaction works is you start by clearing the number of blocks to zero, which means that you have to finish anything else that was using the log and like get it written to the main disk. And then you write the changed blocks to the log. Then finally, you update the log header to point to the locations where those changed blocks go, and also to say the number of blocks. And this single sector write is what commits the transaction. That when we reboot, XV6 reads this and says, oh, that's not zero. I'm going to have to do all the writes that you listed in this log header. Then it writes the data. And this is the part which is redone on reboot if we discover the log header is not zero. And after it writes the data, it can clear the log header and set it back to zero, which it knows is safe because, it knows the operation's actually done. Okay. So questions on how this works? So real journaling file systems do something similar, except they maybe support more operations than just change a block to something else, and they will usually have a log of not just one transaction, but a whole bunch of transactions in order so they don't have to wait for the previous one to finish to start a new one. Okay. Question? Yeah.
So how does this work if we're trying to write a really big file? The log is a fixed size.
The question is, how does this work if we're trying to write a really big file? So typically what you'll do is, if you can't write it in one transaction. So you'll have one transaction which writes the first part, another which writes the second part. There's also another thing which will come up, which is that some file systems don't log everything, which we'll get to later. But a good question is, like, what goes in a transaction? Like, is it writing the whole file? Is it each little update to the file? Each time I call write, is that a transaction? Is each, like, 1,000 bytes of my write a transaction? We have to choose that. And we actually want transactions to be as big as we can get away with. And this is because we write, for each transaction, we write everything in order. And we have to do as much writing in order to the disk as possible. So we actually want to group lots of possibly not directly related updates together into one transaction. If I'm writing a whole bunch of files, I want them to all be together in the log. I then write one commit message, and I update those on disk in any order. And this is typically what journaling file systems try to do, is they just do a whole bunch of updates together in one transaction rather than writing all these little transactions separately. And that's fine because we're typically, when we're using our system, we're updating a whole bunch of files and we can put them together opportunistically. In XV6, the way their heuristic for this is they add the update to the current transaction. And they only start a new transaction when there's nothing going on using the disk, or if there's not enough room left in the log to do more, to do the current operation. So there are two issues you might see with redo logging, and one of which was mentioned. We'll talk about the first one here, which is, how big is the log? How do we make sure that the log doesn't keep getting bigger and bigger? And the answer is, we do garbage collection again. We collect log things. We have to remove things from the log after we've written the real copies. And that's not actually so trivial. And hopefully this happens in the background. So typically the way we want redo logging to work is that, you know, when you're, you know, that the application's only waiting for us to write to the log, and while we're, you know, waiting for user input or something, we finish the rest of the operation and actually copy that to the real place on disk without the application waiting for us to do that. But we can tell the application, and correctly, that, hey, yep, your file is written. It's going to be there even if we lose power. And that makes it really convenient. We had the problem mentioned that this seems really expensive because we're writing our data twice. We're writing a copy of the data to the log, then we're writing it to the disk. And isn't this really a problem? And performance-wise, it's less of a problem than you might think. So remember that lots of files are small, and the log is written sequentially. And if we're talking about writing not very big files, most of the cost of writing lots of files is actually seeking. And the log saves us so much time in that, that it can be well worth it from a performance point of view, even though we're writing more data. So one way of thinking about it is, let's say we're writing a whole lot of files, like 1,000 files. If we were doing that careful ordering, the most obvious way of doing it would be that we'd have to, you know, write to the block map, write to the inode, write to the directory entry, write the data, and do that separately for each file, which is like seeking 1,000 times. With the log, we have a very straightforward way of doing it with basically two seeks. We write all the 1,000 files to the log, then we write all their data seeking to the parts of the disk they're on just once. And it doesn't matter if we write the directory entry of the file first, we just write it in whatever order it is on the disk. So this often ends up really helping performance, despite the fact that in this case, we're writing 1,000 files twice instead of once. But the story with big files might not be so great. So, questions here? Okay, so another thing which makes this more practical is that some journaling file systems cheat. So really, we want to keep the data of files consistent. You know, we want to have it be updated in the same sort of way. A bunch of journaling file systems, at least by default, don't work this way. Sometimes they only use the log for metadata, for like directory entries, for inodes, but not for the data. They just let the data get corrupted, be inconsistent, have the wrong version. They're fine with that, but they just keep the metadata. And this sure deals with that problem of, oh gosh, we're writing way too much to the log and writing it again at the cost of that on a crash, you might actually lose some data or have the wrong version of a file or something like that. But it is a surprisingly popular choice. Okay, so any questions about redo logging? Okay, so redo logging was a way of keeping our file data consistent. So let's talk about another thing file systems can do to aid with recovery. And this is dealing with a completely different problem than what we talked about so far. So previously we talked about what if I have a hardware failure and a disk stops working, or now what if I'm trying to write something in the middle of that something breaks. But here I'm going to say, what if I just want automatic backups? So I want to just keep old versions of files around because I know people accidentally delete things. And I'd like to have copies of old versions of the file system lying around for a while just in case. And this is something that there's a very elegant scheme for supporting in file systems. And it's in fact really deployed. If you have a department account, our file system uses this, which means that if you ask to hey, I accidentally deleted something, we usually have a copy of it for a while, without needing to go to backup tapes. And the mechanism used for this is going to be copy on write. That whenever you write a new version of something, we're going to write a copy. And we're going to keep the original around until we decide that it's too old. And this gives us automatic backups of everything because we have the old copies lying around. And the change just makes a new copy and points to that. And so let's think about how this works with our inode-based file system. So we're going to copy everything. So let's say I update part of this file. Let's say I update just near the end of this file. I change the data in this big file. So what I'm going to do in that case for copy and write is, if I'm changing this block and this block, I'm going to need to make a copy of those blocks. But I also need to make a copy of the blocks that are referring to them and the blocks that are referring to them. So what I'm going to end up with is to make new copies of these blocks, data blocks down here. I'm going to also need new copies of the indirect blocks that point to them to point to the copy and not the original, because I want to still have the old version. And I'm going to make new copies of this indirect block. But I'm going to have pointers to the old stuff, including this, and this, are going to remain the same. And I have a new copy of the inode. So now I have two copies of the inode. I have the copy for the old version, and that's my snapshot. That's what I show to the system administrator when they went to recover your file. We looked at that version. And you say, I accidentally overwrote my important Word document. Yeah, it's there. And we have the new version, which is what we're going to use for your normal accesses. So questions on what you see here. So in this style of file system, writing to a file is just going to make a new version of the inode. And this means that the unchanged parts of the file, they're still shared between the two because it's just pointers. And we're going to have to do some bookkeeping I'm not going to describe to make sure we know when we can actually get rid of those shared parts. We're going to have to do reference counting. It's been the bane of a lot of people in the paging assignment. Same thing applies here. Okay. So this seems straightforward so far, except now we need to track all these different versions of the inode. So we need some way of tracking, you know, what's the current version of the inode for this file? We have like all these different versions as I keep modifying it. And this didn't actually fit so well in the sort of design we saw with Extended 2 or XV6 file system, where we had just this array of inodes and we referred to an index into the array. Well, that doesn't work so well if that index keeps changing. How do we deal with that? Do we like also copy the directory and the directory that it refers to? Like, it seems like everything we would have to change, like all the directories up to the root. And that's not what we're going to do. But we're going to have to use something other than just an inode array to manage this. And our solution is that we're going to use a similar sort of scheme to how we're taking the file and only copying the parts which changed. And we're going to use that for the whole inode array. So we're going to have multiple versions of the inode array. But rather than copying the whole inode array, we'll construct the inode array as pointers to little pieces of the inode array. So we'll split our inode array into pieces, and our old inode will be in one of these pieces. Okay? And we'll have a bunch of indirect blocks, just like our files, pointing to those pieces. And what's is called sometimes the root inode. So this root inode points to all the pieces of the inode array, and that's how we find an inode by number. Just like how we find a particular block of a file, same idea, but this is for finding the inode file metadata for that file number. And when we make a new version of the inode, we just create a new copy of that piece of the inode array and all the pointers to it, which means we aren't changing that much. We're changing here, here, and here. And if we group this update with a bunch of other file updates, it's not going to have that big a cost. So questions, what I did here? And again, you know, notice that we're sharing most of the actual inode, so we're just copying these little pieces that we need for this update to a file and not everything. And the idea is that we get an array of these root inodes, and those are our snapshots. So we just go to a particular place in that array, and we have the file system as of some particular time. If we don't care about keeping all the versions, we can get rid of some of the middle ones and just only keep like every hour or something like that. Question? Is it like a version control system? It's a similar idea to how version control, but this is like part of the file system, like, and there's no add operation or push or anything like that. So indirection makes it so these copies are viable because we only copy the pieces we need, and the otherwise we just point to the same thing that the old version pointed to. And that's why we can keep making copies sort of our entire file system, because we're not actually copying everything, we're just copying the pieces which changed and pointers to the pieces which changed. And in practice, you know, this is a real thing, as I said, on the department machines. So if you go to this directory on a department machine, you can get things like the contents of your files at a particular date and time, assuming it's not too long ago. So this copy on write scheme is, you know, a nice elegant way to have automatic backups. It also has a nice interaction with logging. It's another answer to the question of, I don't like writing two copies. Well, it interacts well with logging because you can think of the updating that inode as sort of a commit operation. But to avoid writing two copies, rather than writing a copy to the log and then writing a new version, we just write the new version to a location that's unused rather than putting it where the previous data was. So we don't need to worry about writing it separately and then moving the update. And we can still have that consistency that either we're looking at the old snapshot or the new one. Just like with transactions, either we're looking at the data before the commit or after the commit. Okay. So questions on this? Okay. So talk about file systems. So something to talk about generally with file systems. We talked about implementing these file systems, but we need to actually make them available. And there needs to be some scheme for that. And commonly we have multiple file systems. And the sort of Unix way of doing this is that we have a root file system that appears as slash, and we have some abstraction layer which lets other file systems appear as some directory. And these are called mounts. So for example, in a department machine, you can see that I have a local file system as slash, and a file system in netzf2, in local temp, all these different file systems that appear as directories. But to implement that, we need some abstraction layer in the kernel, because now the kernel isn't just one file system, it needs to talk to all these different file systems, and it needs to figure out how to do that based on what directory we're talking about. So I'll talk about what Linux does for this. So Linux has something it calls internally the virtual file system API. And this is what file systems implement. If you want to make a new file system in Linux, you implement this API. And it's basically just an object-oriented representation of the file system. It has an object for the header of the file system, for each file called an inode, for each directory entry, and for each open file. And you just implement the particular behavior for your file system for each of these parts of things. And you get to take advantage of common code that deals with things like traversing directories. So you, like in the FAT file system, you have to do that yourself. In Linux, like that's the same for all the different file systems. So there's one version of that code. You just implement the directory entries and the files, and it handles the rest for you. Yeah. The question is, what if it is an FFS style? So then you have to fake it. So for example, the FAT file system implementation, it has to implement the inode class. So the inode class probably like needs to point to a directory entry instead of an inode, which is awkward. But that's what you have to do. Okay. And other questions? So each of these objects has operations that you know would be familiar to you. And like what we saw before for devices, we just have a table of function pointers. And that's just because it's not C++ or Java. We can't have real virtual methods. So Linux does it by hand. Okay. So any questions on virtual file systems? Okay, so next time we'll start talking about distributed systems and sockets. But one last topic on file systems. So we talked about ordering things carefully and making sure that you get the data on disk. So it turns out there's kind of a POSIX API for doing this yourself called fsync, which says, yes, I really want this file's data on disk. So even though we talked about all these ways of making sort of, I write a file and making sure it's really there, remember that we have this page cache. So that's not really the contract that we have with applications. You write a file, we just guarantee that, you know, if you read the file, it's there. We don't guarantee it's on disk yet. If you want that, you need to do something extra. And the POSIX mechanism for this is that there's a call called fsync where you can say, no, really, I want that file I wrote on disk right now. And you would think that this would be all you need to do, but there are some nasty caveats in practice. This is surprisingly difficult to just say, no, really, I wrote this file. Make sure it's on disk in case I crash. It's not actually an easy thing to do in most operating systems. Okay, and that's all I have for today. So next time we'll start talking about distributed systems.